VHF rig are suppressed by 60 decibels or more, the amount of VHF energy you're transmitting from your HF transmitter is going to be very small. So I think with a couple of foot of spacing, I give you a 98% chance it's going to work like a charm. And there's a way you can quantify it if you want to. That is, disconnect the VHF antenna from the normal transceiver it's connected to. Connect it to whatever kind of instrumentation you've got that can measure signal strength. In the worst case, it's a power meter into a dummy load. More likely, it's going to be something like a spectrum analyzer, or it could be a crystal diode detector after a significant number of decibels of attenuator. You could start off with, let me pick a number, a 30 decibel attenuator. Connect it to the VHF coax transmission line. On the far end of that is your crystal diode detector going into a digital voltmeter or an oscilloscope. You transmit on the HF antenna, find out how much is coming down the line of the VHF antenna. Start off with a 30 dB attenuator. With that, you're very unlikely to blow the crystal diode detector. And if it's below detection, go from 30 dB attenuation down to 20 dB attenuation. So by various means, you can measure the amount of cross-coupling. And if, let me pick a number, in the worst case, it's unlikely, but in the worst case, you transmit your full power on the HF antenna, and you find out the VHF antenna has 1 watt coming down it, but by various means, you can confirm that the 1 watt is on, let me pick a number, 7 megacycles, and that 1 watt of power is about to go into the front end of a VHF transceiver. 1 watt is pushing it. A tenth of a watt would be safe. A tenth of a watt on an HF frequency roaring into the front end of a VHF receiver. A tenth of a watt, 100 milliwatts. I'm 99% sure that that's not going to create damage. It might create some intermods while you're receiving on VHF, but it's not going to create damage to the transceiver on VHF. And as far as the VHF signal hurting the HF, again, you can do that cross-coupling measurement. And again, because of the drastic differences in frequency, particularly if you're using an antenna tuner, which is a real good bandpass filter, I think the HF antenna is going to be pretty safe. So you can measure and quantify the amount of cross-coupling. And let me drop. In many situations, you will be very pleasantly surprised as to how close they can be. Now, where this really came into effect is if you take a look at the April issue of QST and the section where the doctor is in, and Mr. Harris was being asked the question, I'm putting these two antennas in the attic, and I don't want cross-coupling between these two antennas on these two different bands. And Mr. Harris was telling them they better be 20 feet apart. In my opinion, that is a super conservative answer. I did the calculation on the frequency of interest, and the amount of free space coupling between the two, even if the antenna on the wrong frequency had 0 dB of gain over ISO, on the wrong frequency the average antenna has minus 10 or minus 20 dB of gain, but 20 feet of spacing is 45 decibels of isolation just because of inverse square law of free space. 20 feet, in my opinion, is way beyond the requirement. It's a good answer, much too conservative, much too restrictive. Many a guy doesn't have that much space in his attic to create 20 feet of separation. I am convinced that with proper measurements, the spacing between the two, recognizing the differences in frequencies and filtering of the rigs, I know it can be a hell of a lot closer than 20 feet. I've very often done it, not run into a problem. Simultaneous transmitting on one and receiving on the other, it might give you some grief because receivers are so super sensitive to local intermodulation distortion. But if I'm transmitting in one and worrying about damage of the other, you'd be amazed what you can get away with. And there's a fairly simple formula I can give you that allows you to calculate ahead of time how many dB of separation, how many dB will the isolation be due to free space loss if you know the frequency and you know the number of feet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Over to you, Neil. K2's Charlie Mike Quebec, K2RIW in the TechNet.
By all means, please, let me have that formula.
Okay. This is a universal formula. We should all burn it into our brain or write it somewhere on the wall and on a piece of paper and look at it from time to time. Decibels of free space loss equals 36.6 plus 20 log foxtrot plus 20 log delta. I'll explain that now. 36.6 plus 20 times the log to the base 10 of foxtrot, meaning frequency, and frequency must be in megahertz, and plus 20 log to the base 10 of delta. Delta is distance in miles. Yes. So 20 log F in megahertz, 20 log delta in miles. And you and I know that 5,280 feet is 1 mile, so if I was separating the two by 10 feet, the 20 log delta would be 20 log of 10 divided by 5,280. That's going to come up with a great big negative number, if you know what I mean. So that formula gives you, the way I gave you the formula, you're going to come up with a positive number of decibels. It really is negative decibels. It really is loss, if you know what I mean. So whenever you know the frequency in megahertz and the distance in miles, that formula will tell you exactly how many decibels of loss there is between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna. There's a 2% chance. I've got to double check that the F should be in megahertz. I'm pretty sure it is. Back to you, Neil. KC2, Charlie Mike, Quebec, KQLIW.
Well, thank you very much, Dick. That pretty much answers my questions. Have a good evening.
Okay. I know it's awful late, but we've had some exciting subjects tonight. Let's still go to the mailbag, John. 2WGB, KQLIW, check that. Molecule floating around in space, and you want to measure what is the temperature of that hydrogen carbon. telescope at that cloud or at that star, and you measure the amount of 1420 megahertz energy with a radiometer, a 1420 megahertz radiometer. And those radiometers at those 1.4 gigahertz frequencies typically had 100 megahertz of bandwidth and sometimes beyond. And you measure the amount of energy coming out of that receiver when the radio telescope is aimed at that cloud and then swished over and aimed at a cold part of space, and you look at the ratio between the two, or by a Dickey switch, switching relay at the front end, you flip back and forth between the amount of noise you're hearing from that cloud in space versus the amount of noise you're getting from a 50-ohm resistor that's in your laboratory, and you try to match the two. Maybe you're cryogenically cooling the resistor, maybe you're heating the resistor, but you're doing something to the resistor, the 50-ohm resistor, so that it makes the exact same amount of noise or a calibrated difference in noise between the radio telescope aimed at the cloud, the unknown cloud, versus the known noise coming out of your resistor, because you know its impedance and you know its temperature. That is a
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
What I just described is a classic radio telescope type RF radio. Okay. Now the people who build optical detectors, your photo meter for your photography that we used in the old days, is a kind of radiometer. And if you go to the right website, you'll find out that the amount of energy coming out of the sun, getting through our atmosphere on a clear day, follows a particular curve that looks a little bit like a Gaussian curve, where the majority of the energy coming through the atmosphere is somewhere around 550 nanometers of wavelength. That's the middle of yellow-green light. So the majority of the light coming through the atmosphere has the highest amount of energy there, and it just happens to be the place where the human eye has the maximum sensitivity. Ain't that a coincidence? It looks like we are designed by Mother Nature, by evolution, by whatever, by him, we are designed for this particular environment. And as you look at that curve of the energy coming from the sun getting through the atmosphere on a clear day, the maximum of that curve is around 550 nanometers. It gets weaker in the infrared region. It gets weaker as you go down in frequency, longer wavelengths, and it also gets weaker as you go up to the ultraviolet frequency. So you got this classic curve of how much energy is coming from the sun at various wavelengths. And how did you really do that? Yes, with various kinds of filters. You could, if you want to, use a prism to break it up into those various wavelengths, and now you can put your photometer, which is a kind of radiometer, into the portion of the light that you're seeing, the red portion, the yellow-green portion, the blue portion, and so on, and measure the amount of response of your photometer, assuming that your photometer has been properly calibrated, because it has a transfer curve.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It has a transfer curve as a function of wavelength. Your photometer, unless it's a very expensive one, it is not flat as a function of wavelength. If this is the best of all worlds, I'd like to be able to build up a photometer. I'd like to be able to buy a photometer that has the exact same amount of response to far infrared, near infrared, or the optical region, violet, near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, x-rays. I'd like to have a photometer that is completely flat. Unless you spend a lot of money, you ain't going to get that. So there's a calibration curve you need for your photometer, which when you combine it with what you see with your prism, yes, you can now measure the amount of energy in each of those wavelengths. And you got one other problem. Let me drop. And that is, the energy you're measuring is the kind of broadband noise. The signal you got out of that hydrogen cloud of free hydrogen electrons at a certain temperature in free space, it really was a noisy signal. As you double the bandwidth of the receiving device, the radiometer, in general, if it's a flat noise versus wavelength, you'll double the amount of energy. So therefore, whenever you measure noise power, it's not measuring noise power in, let me think, microwatts, nanowatts, milliwatts, whatever. It is watts per megahertz. A 50-ohm resistor makes a very calibrated amount of pure random noise, a 50 ohm resistor into a impedance matched receiver, will give you minus 114 dBm per megahertz of bandwidth. Minus 114 dBm is room temperature, 50 ohm resistor into a perfect receiver. If you did it, if your receiver was not 1 megahertz wide, minus 114 dBm, but was 2 megahertz wide, you would measure 3 dB more than minus 114. It'd measure high minus 111. So whenever you measure broadband noise of some kind with a radiometer, it is power per bandwidth. So the filter that you're using to pass the green, the red, the ultraviolet, or whatever coming out of your prism, you have to know what is its bandwidth in, let's say, megahertz, so that when you make the measurement, you know what it is in watts per megahertz, because that's the way broadband noise is measured. In the case of a crystal-controlled oscillator at, say, 10 megahertz, let me drop. In theory, all of its energy is at one frequency, 10 megahertz, and you go 3 kilohertz above or 3 kilohertz below, and there's essentially nothing there. A good crystal oscillator, reference oscillator at 10 megs, all of the power is at 1 meg, at one particular frequency. In that circumstance, you can pour that into a pure power meter made by Hewlett-Packard, or Hewlett-Packard 435, for instance, and you'll measure an amount of milliwatts or watts of power. When the frequency is really one frequency only, then you can measure the power directly and don't worry about bandwidth. But in the real world of broadband noise generators, and that's where the majority of the world is, majority of the universe, you have to define watts per megahertz in order to define what you've just measured. I know I went pretty far left of center of what you were asking, but maybe that helps a little bit, John. KC2WGB, nothing as simple, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, yeah, is that true? Nothing is. Okay, again, his question was the radiometer, the simple radiometer, it's like in the light bulb, will he notice the different speed or different rotating speed of that radiometer with different light waves at different frequencies? That's really what he was interested in. Do you think he'll be able to see that with just a prism?
Oh, boy, am I way off on this one. I took literally the word radiometer from a radio telescope point of view or a photometer point of view. And yes, there is this object with four vanes in a glass bulb with partially evacuated air in that bulb, and this object with four vanes on a pivot where it can rotate. The four vanes are silvered on one side and black on the other side, and that is called a radiometer. And everyone wants to believe that that thing rotates because the light bounces off the silvered side and imparts a certain amount of momentum to that wave, to that vane, and the light bouncing off the black side gets absorbed and therefore doesn't bounce. And they want to believe the bouncing and the dynamics of bouncing of the individual photons of light is making it rotate. You study that radiometer and you find out it turns in the wrong direction. It turns in such a way that the black veins move away from the source of light. And why is that? Let me drop. Because what's really going on is that the photo pressure of bouncing photons on that vein is many orders of magnitude weaker than what is really taking place. What's really taking place is that the air in the room with you right now, at room temperature and room pressure, the average air molecule is moving 500 meters per second. That's the speed, the average speed of the air molecules in the room with you right now. You partially evacuate that volume of air. You do that so that you have less air resistance, but still there's enough air molecules inside of that bulb. And those air molecules running at 500 meters per second, the ones that hit the black side of the veins, which are hotter, get heated up. And the temperature of an air molecule is the kinetic energy of its velocity. Your thermometer, you think it's measuring temperature, is really measuring the average speed of the air molecules if it's an air measuring thermometer, or in the case of water, the average speed of the water molecules. So the air molecules hitting the black side get heated up, move faster, therefore they leave the black side with a higher velocity than the silvered side, and that makes it move away. So it's the kinetic energy of the air molecules in the radiometer that's turning it. Now the radiometer, with its silvered side, I'd like to believe if they've done a good job of silvering, that all the wavelengths that you can see, that you care about, are being thoroughly reflected. Let me drop. And if they've done a real good job of putting the sooty black material on the black side, it's a thoroughly black body absorber at all frequencies. Therefore, that radiometer is a pretty good broadband power measuring device. Yeah. If you've done a good job of putting on the black material so that it's very absorptive at all the wavelengths you care about, and if you did a good job of the silvering so that it's thoroughly reflective of all the wavelengths you care about, therefore, whether you put in red, yellow, green, or violet energy into the radiometer, the rate at which it's turning will be proportional to the amount of energy at the wavelengths you're hitting it with. It is a pretty nice broadband detector. It's a black body detector, and the amount of energy equals the amount of heat of the black material. So that as a detecting device is, in my opinion, pretty broadband and pretty flat. Interesting. You've got to worry about what wavelengths pass through the grass. The air molecules don't give a darn about what wavelengths is passing through them. It's transparent. The air molecules running around inside that bulb only care about what is the temperature of the black surface they're about to encounter. Now, if I was looking at violet light with that radiometer and counting the RPM, that's a good measure of power output at violet. But you'd have to also know what is the bandwidth of the violet being passed by your filter. Because, once again, it's a dBm per megahertz, if you know what I mean. So, bandwidth times power equals the total energy that's going in there. So I think he's onto something here, John. I never realized how flat in performance that thing called radiometer could be. Wow.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's a beauty. Hey, John, you're communicating with a scientist. KC2WGB. I mean, that guy who wrote to you, K2LIW in the tech net.
KC2WGB. 17 years old, Dick. And I think it's an excellent question. From what you're telling me, if there was a way to incorporate the prism assembly inside of the radiometer so that we didn't have to worry about the attenuation of the glass, I think that would even be more adventurous. Probably difficult to do. But okay. And do you think the radiometer will respond to ultraviolet as well as infrared?
There's a yes and a no to that, John. Assuming the glass bulb of the radiometer, assuming that the glass is transparent, and you go to the right reference, the right website, the right Google search, you will find out exactly how absorptive is your kind of glass at each wavelength. I know for a fact that if I was doing a far infrared measurement, because I'm using a thermal imaging camera, the lens on the thermal imaging camera, to my eye, looks black. I think it's made out of quartz, but I'm not sure, quite sure. Quartz or germanium. Anyway, you have to choose a material that acts like a lens at that wavelength. Ordinary glass, when you get down to infrared, is not very transparent anymore. So a different kind of lens is required. But with the right kind of research and knowing the kind of glass that's on the bulb of your radiometer, you could know how much transparency that glass has. Once you get by the glass transparency problem, and I think the ultraviolet is reasonably transparent to the kind of glass, then the only other thing you've got to worry about is the silvering still highly reflective at the ultraviolet, and is the black soot still highly absorptive? And again, with the right research, you can find that out. Because it is relatively easy to make a black body absorber, sooty-like materials are extremely broadband as an absorber. So the chances are the absorber has high quality from near infrared, through the optical, through the ultraviolet. I think that's properly constructed. Let me drop it. Properly constructed black sooty materials could be highly absorptive at all of those wavelengths. So, step number one is the glass transparent. Step number two is the black stuff thoroughly absorptive, or absorptive in a manner that is calibratable or documentable. Number three is the silvering reflective, and again, that is documentable when you know the kind of silvering that was put on there. Those are the ingredients. If the glass transmits the wavelength you care about, if the black stuff absorbs it by an amount that you know about, if the silvering side reflects it by the amount you know about, you've solved the equation. You now know the sensitivity of your radiometer at that wavelength. Those are all quantifiable factors as I see it, John. I didn't say it's easy, but you've got the resources to quantify it. And as long as you're willing to measure relatively strong amounts of light, like what you get from the sun, I mean, by photometry standards, by low-light photometry standards, that thing called radiometer is not super sensitive. But for reasonably high power levels, like what you get out of the sun, that is, in my opinion, a rather broadband, quantifiable detector. A lot better than I ever realized. Over to you, John, KQRIW. He's got a great future. Let him know that.
I will do that. Yeah, that's exciting. I'd like to know what he finds out. He's in the process of building the prism structure and some lenses to do this. He wants to focus it and all that. So he's got a little, cute little drawing here. And I hope he communicates with me and lets me know what is going on. His name is George, and 17 years old. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to one more. Okay. I have a gentleman who's going to make a trip, and he's bringing his UHF walkie-talkies. Evidently, this is a job, a construction job or something like that. Evidently, there is a half a mile of a horseshoe-shaped six-foot pipe that goes into a hillside, makes a 180-degree turn, and comes back out. Do you think he will be able to communicate with the UHF on this steel-walled pipe? He says it's finished pretty well inside. What do you think about that at waveguide at that frequency? Do you think it's going to work for him? It's a half a mile in a 180-degree turn.
There's a number of big variables required here. So the pipe is a half mile from beginning to end. I'm going to guess somewhere in the middle it makes a 180-degree turn. A big variable is what's the diameter of the pipe. It's a steel pipe. I presume he can walk through it, so it's beginning to sound like it's got quite a few feet of diameter.
6 feet.
Okay, 6 feet of diameter. And now the nature of that 180-degree turn. If those were mitered turns, in other words, where there's a flat wall at a 45-degree angle when it first makes a 90-degree turn, and a little bit downrange is another flat wall at a 45-degree angle when it makes another mitered 90-degree turn, making a total of 180. If that's what it had, that could be a beautiful piece of waveguide. You'd get great transmission. If, by comparison, it was a nice, very slow rotation, could still work very well. I'm kind of concerned, as you can tell, about the 180-degree turn. And if, at worst, the 180-degree turn is a problem, there's a beautiful, simple solution to this one. And that is, at the beginning of the turn, he sets up a good receiving antenna, positions it so he gets a good signal from it, runs a coax cable over to the end of the turn, and retransmits the signal thoroughly passively. So even if the turn creates a whole lot of insertion loss, the quarter mile of pipe going into the turn, the quarter mile of pipe coming back out of the turn, 6-inch diameter, good steel pipe, UHF frequency, that could be a beautiful piece of waveguide. Let me drop. Which might give you a very small amount of signal drop. And the signal drop in insertion loss could be considerably lower than free space. A good handy talkie has no trouble talking a mile of line of sight. And this kind of steel waveguide, if it's got reasonable conductivity, could be considerably stronger than free space. Waveguide is like that at times, particularly over overmoded waveguide. This waveguide is many wavelengths of diameter. That's overmoded. You may have to move around a little bit on the handy talkie on each end to make sure you're not in a peak or a valley of response. So I'm only worried about the 180-degree turn, and if the 180-degree turn turns out to be a problem, and you can prove that real fast, have your buddy walk down there with the handy talkie up to the turn and talk to him. So the quarter mile of walk up to the turn, if you get a beautiful strong signal, but then it dies around the turn, there's a simple solution, setting up these two passive antennas with a piece of cable in between. KC2WGB, great experiment. Is that going to take place in the near future, John? K2LAW in the TechNet?
Yes, it is, Dick. In fact, he's traveling out there next month, I think on the 17th, he said. And he will get back to me, let me know. He was going to listen tonight. I hope he is. And this is a U-shape, which he drew here. I don't know the radius of curvature, but it looks like the legs of the U are a little bit longer, and it looks like most of the curve is taking place, like I would say, one-third is the curve, the other two-thirds of the straight legs coming back out. Whether that's going to make a difference or not, I don't know.
I'm slowly concluding that the U-turn is not going to be a big problem. The straight portions of the pipe are not going to be a big problem per se, but there's a catch. If he's walking into a completely dry piece of steel pipe, and his feet are on that steel, it's the world's most beautiful piece of waveguide. It's going to work very well at UHF, and I think it's going to work very well at 2 meters, and it might even work very well at 6 meters. Another set of interesting experiments. But there's a catch. If it's now a sewer pipe and he's walking through slushy water or dirt or some other absorptive material, and the way waveguide really works, you would like to believe that you hold up a straight piece of waveguide and you look into it with your eye at one end and you see something coming out the other end. The way your eye travels straight down the piece of waveguide, you'd like to believe the RF energy does that. It absolutely does not. Let me drop. Because as you go to higher and higher frequencies where the waveguide is a larger and larger number of wavelengths in width, yes, the signal goes into a more and more shallow angle of bouncing off the walls, and at an infinite frequency like light, when you're a million times higher in frequency where the waveguide would normally work, yes, the signal then for the first time goes straight down the center of the guide. But at real RF frequencies, the only way the RF energy can get down there is it must bounce off the walls. And the angle of the bounce is a function of how many wavelengths is the waveguide wide compared to the frequencies you're using. So the signal has to bounce off the walls. Depending on the diameter of the pipe determines the angle of the bounce and how many bounces it takes to go that half mile. And if every one of those bounces is going through slushy water that you're wading through, which is a fairly absorptive material, you could start losing the signal fairly fast. So what he's walking on is going to be a big factor of how fast the signal falls off. But if that pipe was clean, he could very well get a signal going through the pipe considerably stronger than he would through free space. At 6 meters, 2 meters, and UHF frequencies, John, KC2WGB, K2LAW, love to hear what he finds out on this one.
Yeah, interesting. I'd like to find out, too. I hope this also gets back to me. By the way, Dick, the floor, the only moisture, he said, is possible condensation that appears as temperature changes. That's the only moisture. And they do have a rubber mat on the floor for non-slip. But that's the only, and there are no protrusions. This is a smooth wall structure. There's no fittings or elements of connecting pipes or anything like that. It's just straight in tube, around and back out. I have no idea what the use of this thing is for. But, yeah, interesting.
A water under normal circumstances in coax cable can be extremely lossy, particularly if it's distributed throughout the foam of a cable or a couple of drops of water at your type-in connector or your UHF connector. Water can be very lossy at VHF, UHF frequencies. However, water of condensation gathering on the wall of a steel pipe, you and I know that the water is going to have a thickness of a small fraction of a millimeter. And when you're working at a wavelength of 70 centimeters, that's nothing. That's so small a fraction of a wavelength. I wouldn't even care if that was salty water. If you had to try to make that film of water, of condensation on the walls. You try to make it lossy. You couldn't do it. There's not enough thickness there to do it. So the water on the walls doesn't bother me. The rubber mat, unless the rubber is made out of carbon granules, and it's intentionally made, let me drop. Unless the rubber mat he's walking on is not intentionally constructed as anechoic material, something like polyurethane foam with a liberal sprinkling of carbon granules through it. That's how you make the pyramids of the walls of an anechoic chamber. So unless they've done that, the rubber is a very low absorption material. The water on the walls is a very low absorption material. The steel pipe with all of its properly made joints is a very low loss piece of waveguide. He could get a signal that's going down there that's gangbusters, as long as he's properly positioning the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna. He will, in that pipe, be in a very rich multi-path environment. In other words, there's a zillion, literally a zillion ways that the signal can bounce down that pipe and get to the far end. And if he tells the guy at the far end to key down on the transmitter and hold steady and transmit for the next 60 seconds, while he takes his handy-talky and moves it left and right, up and down, forward and back, and twists it in polarization, he will find, if he's looking at the signal transmitter, he will find a number of peaks and valleys. Every time he moves a half wavelength in any one direction, he'll find peaks and valleys. So except for some occasional nulls, that signal should get down there like gangbusters. I'm not as worried about going around the corner anymore. That's going to be an interesting experiment. What is the reason that pipe is there if you have an Energon? KC2WGB, KQLAW?
Dick, haven't got a clue. He didn't clue me in on that. But also, if he does have a problem, you basically touched on it, could he put, say, a mag mount at the U, at the start of the U, and a piece of coax cable with another mag mount at the exit of the U part, and sort of cover both tubes? Would that help him?
Absolutely. That's called a passive repeater system. You'd be amazed how many of those have been set up on the top of a mountain. If I'm in this valley, and there's a mountain between me and you, and you're in the next valley, and so therefore we've got this mountain in between us, at VHF and UHF frequencies, for you and I to communicate is going to be very difficult. If within the line of sight of me, I put a antenna, particularly if it was a Yagi aimed at me, and then with line of sight of you in your valley, there's another Yagi aimed at you, and in between is a piece of coax cable, that could easily make the signal coming from my valley going to your valley end up 60 decibels louder. A million times louder is quite possible in that environment. So he's going to be doing that equivalent. So if at worst he finds out that when his buddy walks down the first leg of the piece of tubing, let me drop, and as he walks, they're continuously communicating between the throat, between the opening of the tubing and the guy walking down. They're continuously talking, and everything's hunky-dory until they get to the U-turn, and then they start losing the signal around the U-turn. I doubt it, but they might. There's a lot of variables here as to the geometry of that turn. If it's a gentle enough turn, no problem. If it's a pretty drastic turn, could be a problem, unless it's a mitered turn. But putting any kind of a receiving antenna at the beginning of the turn with another transmitting antenna at the end of the turn connected with a coax cable, he's now creating a passive repeater. And that could essentially remove the problem of the turn if there is a problem. I think there's only a 10% chance the turn is going to give him a problem. I think this is going to work like a charm. If he's described the steel tubing correctly to us and the materials that are within it correctly, this should be a gangbuster experiment. You get some darn interesting questions, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, and I love reading some of them. They're really out there. The only issue I have with it, which he didn't say again, is kind of incomplete. I just hope he's not going to be in the pipe trying to talk to a construction trailer that's on site outside of it. You know, I mean, he maybe has a chance he'll make it, but I'm hoping it's for internal communications in the pipe, which is what I believe it is from his statements.
But even if that is his next level of problem. There's a simple solution to that one, John. Let's assume that every, let me pick a number, 500 feet down the pipe, there is an opening to the outside world, a small opening with a ladder and whatever. And there's a group of guys out there at that level of the pipe doing whatever, and he wants to talk to them. All he's got to do is to create another passive repeater. He puts the proper kind of an antenna inside the pipe to pick up the signal. It goes to the coax cable up the ladder to the outside world, to the right kind of an antenna in the outside world, and now the people on the outside can communicate with the people inside the pipe anywhere along that pipe if you properly set up those antennas. So the amount of insertion loss of the apertures of the pipe to the outside world are known geometry, are quantifiable as to their insertion loss. And if the insertion loss is so great that he's beyond below threshold of communication, by passive repeating, he can reestablish it. He doesn't even have to go to amplifiers, most likely. So at the open ends of the pipe, he can set up these antennas. At the various apertures in the pipe, he can set up these antennas. These are passive repeater antenna systems. He can create beautiful communication up to, let me pick a number, an eighth of a mile from any of the apertures of the pipe, continuously communicate with all those people up to an eighth of a mile, I guess on my part, anywhere along the pipe at those apertures from people inside the pipe running these handy talkies. It's going to be a great experiment. Over to you, John, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Sure is, Dick. I hope I get some feedback on that. That is something I never tried at that distance anyway. But yeah, that'll be a lot of fun. I've got a few more here, but the only other thing you may want to talk about is that email I sent you, or maybe you'd like to save it for next week because it's so late. What do you think?
Yeah, that was, I think it was KD2DUT. Let me go back to the website I had on him.
His name was Mike.
KA2DUT, I think that's him. Let me go back to that. Yes, that's him. This is an unusual amateur living in Glen Cove. Just happens to own a Cessna 150 airplane. It looks like he has access to, or he owns, what used to be an electronic news gathering truck with a KU-band dish hanging on. It looks like about a 2-footer or 2.5-foot, maybe 3-foot diameter KU-band dish. They probably call it a 1 meter. And it's on a pneumatically telescoping tube coming out of the back of the truck, where according to the serial number on that pneumatic operated tube, it can be anywhere from 7 feet to 30 feet high. Collapsed at 7 feet, most of it's all inside the truck. Expanded, it goes up to 30 feet. Let me drop. And now, if he was using that equipment, even though they removed all the racks of all the broadcast equipment that used to be there, and this was Channel 11 News at one time, it looks like they decided to abandon this truck, and I'm guessing they sold it to him as scrap material. Brand new, that truck, when fully equipped, was well above 100 grand, probably closer to 200 grand with all the electronics inside. And they removed the expensive electronics, and the truck, for all we know, was over 10 years old, I don't know, and maybe he got it for a good price. And now he's got this truck with the pneumatic tubing and the dish, and he can put any electronics in there he wants to. Let me drop it. There are a number of guys I know that would give their ITs for that vehicle. The guys who are on 10 gigs and 24 gigs ham radio, and during the 10 gigs and above contest, and also the UHF and above contest, there's a UHF and above ARL contest in August, in the middle of August. At the end of August and the beginning of December, there's the 10 gig and above contest. And these guys make two shows with each other, and you get points on the number of contacts, the number of kilometers between the contacts, and as long as one of the stations moves to another grid square, you're allowed to talk to those people all over again and add up the score. So you got these guys running around on mountaintops and beachfronts and going from the grid zone to grid zone, Maidenhead grid zones, and running up the scores. And some of them run mountains. So that kind of a vehicle with the right kind of electronics, and it only needs milliwatts of 10 gig and 24 gig signal going into that dish, And with a telescope and tubing, he can get above many of the trees that are mountain, that are on top of those mountains or on those beachfronts. So he could rack up some very nice distances and some very nice scores if he was a 10 gig and 24 gig ham radio operator. Now, those are rare individuals. Let me drop. There's roughly one ham radio operator per 500 people in the general population. When it comes to the very serious VHF, UHF, homebrew, microwave enthusiasts, there's roughly one of them per 500 hams. So, how many of them are in the general population? Four of them per million. A quarter of a million people per one of these very serious VHF, UHF hams. It's a very rare animal. I claim to be one of those, or at least I'm in direct contact with the people that are. Go to Tom Williams' website, KA2 Mike Bravo Alpha, WA1, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. You go to that website and start reading. You'll be in direct contact with those doubly rare human beings, the creme de la creme, so to speak. And so if he gets associated with those, he will go to the top of the list of popularity immediately. Now, the 10 gig operators are very different from a guy on 2 meters. Let me drop. You drive around on 2 meters, you go to a popular repeater like 146.85, and you say that I'm KC2WGB and I'm listening. 80% of the time you're going to get an answer. There's somebody out there in the tri-state area hearing you, and there's a lot of popularity. You get on the 10 gig band at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you say, CQ, CQ, this is KC2WGB on 10.368 gigahertz, carefully tuning the band. You say those words. And by the way, that band is 500 megahertz wide. Thank goodness almost everybody congregates around 10.368.1, the 72nd harmonic of 144 megahertz. Everybody congregates there because you can easily find 72 harmonic from your 144 meg transmitter, and you can easily locate yourself, so to speak. But you get on the favorite frequency, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, during a non-contest, and you call CQ. I give you a 0.1% chance you're going to get an answer. During the contest, you get on 144.26 megahertz, the calling frequency, 144.25 or 26. You go to that calling frequency on 2 meters, and you say, I'm on Greylock Mountain in Vermont. I'm at latitude so-and-so, longitude so-and-so, and I'm looking for a 10 gig QSO. Is anybody out there? During those particular weekends of the August and 10 and September contest, yeah, you're going to get zillions of answers if you're in a good location. And you talk to lots of people with your electronic news gathering truck, your telescoping piece of tubing, put your milliwatt transmitter with the dish with 40 dB of gain. It gets it above the trees. You aim it in the right direction. And you make the contact at, let me pick a number, 200 kilometers easily, and maybe beyond.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And with that truck's mobility and with its ability, you could run up a very nice score once you understand the operating procedures for that band. So if he's willing to join that very rare group, he will be extremely popular immediately. So there's some goods and bads there, as you can see here, John. And there's lots of other ways you can use that truck, so... If he owns it, I think he's going to enjoy it. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, it looks like a fun thing to have, and you could see that was quite an investment, whatever company owned that. And I do believe he bought it outright, used, and they just stripped out the stuff they needed, I guess, or maybe they sold it, and he was left with everything that's there. It's working. So I think he's going to have a good adventure with that. Okay, Dick, that's about it for the mailbag for this week. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, if you guys want to see the pictures that John and I are now describing, you simply go to QRZ.com and dial in Kilo Alpha 2 Delta Uniform Tango. Mike DiMaita, I think is his name. Michael DiMaita. And you look at those pictures of him standing alongside of Donald Trump, consider his Cessna airplane, and look at those zillions of pictures that he's got on one of his websites with his electronic news gathering truck from Channel 11 News that he apparently purchased as a piece of surplus equipment. And he, in theory, can have a lot of fun with that. That's got a lot of capability. My goodness. I'm pretty sure Paul didn't sign in tonight, WS2N. But just for the hell of it, I'll give a shout and see if Paul is there. WS2N, are you there, Paul? K2RIW and the Tech Man?
K2RIW, WS2N. Oh, yeah, I listen to all that. I doubled early on, but I just let it go. I'm always here.
I'm sorry about that, Paul. You, if you want to, can give us a brief report. And one other thing I want to mention is that Christopher and I, my son Christopher, KP2IQN, and I each purchased a Baofeng. This UV5R is the one that we bought. That covers a great big chunk of 70 centimeters and a great big chunk of 2 meters. And the owner's manual they supply is a minor nightmare. The rig has got a lot of capability at a very inexpensive price. You're getting a tremendous amount of electronics per dollar. Oh, man. This thing, by American standards, would be, a few years ago, it would be $350. And it costs you like $39 or $40. It's almost one-tenth the price, if you know what I mean. It's got a lot of capability, but its owner's manual is terrible. However, there is a website where a guy has generated a real owner's manual. You go to that website, you get that owner's manual, and you will fall in love with this rig. Just so they pass it along to you. Paul, go ahead with anything you want to tell us in the 4.5 minutes, 3.5 minutes you got. WS2N, what is NASA doing? KQRIW and the Tech Man.
Okay, Dick. I was going to review the upcoming Mars missions in the not-too-distant future, including November 18th. You've got the Maven mission. I was going to cover that some detail and a couple of the other ones that they've got planned. Curiosity, of course, we could have always covered the findings of what that thing did. It put a grinding of the rock, the one rock, into the SAM unit and then also the Kenman unit and analyzed it. Came up with interesting findings about what Mars looked like. It could have supported life, which is those big. So I wanted to cover the Maven mission in November, and also the InSight mission. There's one called the InSight mission in 2016. We'll talk about that maybe next week as well. That's not a rover, but that will also land on Mars. John will like this. It has a big seismograph on board. It's gonna look for Mars quakes. So it's gonna dig way down into the surface. We'll look forward to talking about that. And the Mars rover for 2020. And the European Space Agency will cover the two Mars. They've got two Mars missions coming up that NASA's involved, and one is also a rover. We'll do that next week. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
You got 1.5 minutes. You probably told us a week or two ago, and I'm so darn forgetful. My two media questions on November 18th of, I presume, 2013, Maven mission. Here's some really dumb questions, Paul. What planet is it going to, possibly Mars or Moon, and what does it intend to measure? So Maven mission, roughly where and what? Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
That's going to be an orbiting Mars mission, around 75 degrees inclination, but highly elliptical, going to drop down to, close to below 100 miles at the low point, and it's going to take measurements of all the gas elements, and it's going to try to figure out the rate that Mars lost its atmosphere and water and how it all happened and when it happened exactly and details about the atmosphere itself. So that's orbital, or that and then one after that in 2016 will be the inside mission. That's a landing, but a land that it's got to dig into the ground. Back to you, Dick.
Fantastic. The Maven mission, 100 miles. I guess I'll do it this way. Got a change. Bye bye.
Hello, 1234. The Maven mission is 100 miles perigee, 50 apogee, 1,000 miles. It's a highly elliptical orbit. So that's my last question, Paul, and thank you. WS2N, K2RIW, I'll hear you any input, so don't worry. Fine, Paul. Lots of Mars missions, as I see. Thank you for that information. 73, you guys, what you just listened to was TechNet number 1441 of the series that began way back in September of 1982. If John and I stay healthy, we hope we will, we'll be back next week. Doing what we think is educational ham radio, a meeting of the minds, a gathering of the clan. I bow you all, be kind to each other. And John, KC2WGB, for any of the comments, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet. Thank you, John. There was a double there between John and Paul. Paul one, and John, please repeat everything you said. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Sorry about that, Paul.
This is KC2WQB. Good night, Dick, and thank you. Great net. Had a lot of fun, and I'm sure we'll have a few more interesting questions next week, and we'll see what happens. You be well.
And, Dick, I want to tell you, it was called the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission. So they come up with the acronym MAVEN. So it's an atmosphere mission.
And we're enjoying it. Just the price is right. Thank you. Bye-bye, John. See you guys later. Be kind to each other again.
I do have number 4.
Sorry about that.
7-3, and just so you know, the Belfong radio has a tissue paper printer. KB2IQN.
Yeah, he's absolutely right. Chris has done a number of tests on the Belfong radio. And if it's held within limits of number 20 feet of any of his computing equipment in his house, it's unable to hear a local repeater. It's got a rather tissue paper front end. It sort of has to, because it's covering a ridiculous bandwidth way below and way above the 2-meter band, and way below and way above the 440 band. So to cover that much bandwidth, and it also covers whole FM broadcast band, 88 to 108. So it would have to have a tissue front end. In other words, you put it near a strong signal, it's going to overload that front end, even though the signal is a large number of megahertz away from the thing you're listening to. But still, the price is right. You're getting a lot for your money. Just know that it can't tolerate a lot of overload. It doesn't have a so-called bulletproof front end. But be warned, K2RIW will be clear.
Have fun, guys.
70 degrees to all on net, and thanks from your friends up here in Toronto, Canada, V3ZZZ. Cleared.
What is the weather like up there in Canada today? We had 40 degrees, 32 degrees, numbers like that down here. What were you getting up there in Ottawa and Toronto, ahead?
We had for this time of the year, we had a beautiful sunny day. It was probably about 44 Fahrenheit, I would guess, but no wind, and very sunny, so it was quite pleasant in the downtown areas.
Doesn't sound to me like those Canadians are suffering very much. You guys get me. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, they don't suffer, just they have a system. Not like us.
Yeah, those guys, Scott and Jim, they apparently know, they know where to live, John. Whereas these people on the island of Long and the island of Staten or the island of Richmond, I don't know, are they quite as smart, John? What do you think?
Well, I know we don't have some of the problems we have, but when I look at Canada, I just think it's, like, too cold for me, Dick. I think New York is too cold.
Are you telling me, John, that just like Seinfeld says, after you hit 65, you must retire to Florida? That's the law. You're telling me you're looking at Florida with